Hello and welcome to the EI podcast. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined today by Stephen Kotkin. Now, Stephen has taught at Princeton, at Stanford University, and is the Kleinheinz Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's an expert on Russian and European affairs and has written and spoken extensively on subjects ranging from the rule of Joseph Stalin to authoritarianism and current geopolitical risk. And talking of that, welcome, Stephen.
Thank you so much.
Talking of geopolitical risk, you're an expert on Russia. Your deep, deep knowledge of the deep history of that continent-sized land. And I just wondered, where are we at the moment? We seem to be in something of a stalemate. There are big words used, but I don't feel as though there's a great deal of light being shed on this situation. So what light can you shed on the current situation in Russia and its relationship with the rest of the world?
Yes, the war's been going on for some time, obviously. Catherine the Great in 1783 seized Crimea, not from the Ukrainians, but from the Tatars. So it's not a war that began in 2022, and it's not a war that began in 2014. And so it may not end very quickly, despite people's hopes. A lot is in the hands of the Europeans right now. They've been bluffing for some time. Now they're promising soldiers they don't have to help enforce a peace that doesn't exist. The latest incursions into the territory of NATO countries by Russian drones have caused a bit of a tizzy. But of course, Russia's been conducting hybrid warfare, sabotage, cyber crimes, and cyber destabilization for as long as anybody can remember, including in Estonia, where the recent drone incursion was. So we're in a phase here where we're still at pretense rather than serious action. And that's because Europe is made up of very fine, very well-off pacifist societies with few exceptions. And even when they reinvest in military hardware, in dual-use technologies, they still don't really have armies. They don't have soldiers. And of course, that's a really big problem. But beyond that, they have societies that are not interested in preparing for war, let alone fighting war. And so this is a challenge for us all to figure out what, if anything, might be done about this. It's one thing to say, well, let's make more munitions, or let's have some more anti-aircraft. But who's going to man them, and also not just build them, and also who's going to be there for the next stage should it evolve to the next stage? So it's very troubling to see where we are. On the Russian side, they have won the war without actually winning it. And that's because they have two ways to win. One is to achieve their maximalist aims, which would be subordination of Ukraine, plus eviction of American power from Europe and rollback of NATO, rolling back the post-1991 settlement, pushing us back to pre-97 at a minimum, which means the NATO expansion era. That's the goal. But if they don't achieve that maximalist goal, they still win the war by wrecking Ukraine. In other words, Ukraine needs Ukraine. Russia doesn't actually need Ukraine. And so wrecking Ukraine is a form of victory, even as Russia fails to achieve its aims in the war. The fact that they can continue to do this has surprised a lot of people, although they have been doing it now for 300 years. This overinvestment in the military, overinvestment in domestic repression, the security apparatus, suppression of consumption, and aggression towards their neighbors and beyond their neighborhood. So that they may run out of money here, run out of money there, have some financing trouble this, have some technological challenges there, and somehow they manage. This is what they do. This is the system that they've had, more or less, in variations, not identical, Tsarist period, Soviet period, and today. In World War II, they relied on the United States for the Lend-Lease. which was absolutely vital for their war effort. Now they're relying on China for the dual use. So China plays the role today that Lend-Lease played then, even a greater role, you could argue, today, although the role of Lend-Lease was colossal. So Russia seems to be able to do this, and so it's not likely to miraculously end. And therefore, there needs to be very significant pressure on the Putin regime. So far, the pressure has been on the battlefield, military pressure, and in the economic sphere, sanctions. Sanctions are something you do when you don't want to send your boys and girls to die. That's what sanctions are. They don't often change the calculus of the adversary, but they do allow you to look like you're doing something without risking the lives of your boys and girls. So if you're not going to risk the lives of your boys and girls on the front line, and by the way, Ukraine needs 500,000 18 to 24-year-olds that they don't themselves have. That's the need on the battlefield right now. If you don't have that and you do the sanctions, it can look like you are applying maximalist pressure. But of course, the pressure needs to be in the political domain. The Putin regime will continue this unless it feels its regime is at stake. Maintenance of the regime, preservation of Putin's personal power, that trumps all other goals. And if he doesn't feel his personal regime is at risk, then he's going to spend those lives he doesn't care about. He's going to use that Chinese assistance, which is forthcoming. And he's going to wreck Ukraine and win the war that way, even if he can't achieve his maximalist aims. But who knows? Maybe he can achieve his maximalist aims, because on the European side, despite the size of the economies, the size of the population, despite the rhetoric of various different governments, despite the commitment to Ukraine in so many ways, economically, rhetorically, military hardware, the failure to engage in the political domain and apply pressure against Putin means that he can continue this and Ukraine continues to lose, even though Russia's not winning in the maximalist sense. So I think that's where we are, and that's 3+ years now of where we are.
Hmm. And you don't paint a very encouraging picture of European response to Putin. What could they do that would be effective? However unlikely the odds or possibilities of that, what is it that Europe could really do practically to turn this around, or at least to offer a more positive future?
Well, it could in the sense of, in theory could, and then could in the sense of within the constraints of the societies, polities, political systems, and public opinion, the mood in the countries, right? So if you're thinking about could in the sense of no constraints on governments or societies or public opinion, that's one version. We don't get that. We get that only rhetorically. And that's because of all these other constraints. So you need to have significant conscription. You need to build really large armies, navies, and air forces. Of killers, of soldiers who can kill, not build homes or roads or sing songs, all of which they can do now. There are many brave people in Europe, but they're just not interested in war. And getting them interested in war is a political lift that we really don't see on the horizon. Of course, there is Finland. They have a land army. It's quite formidable land army, especially on a per capita basis. It's unbelievably impressive. That's because they were not in NATO. They had no choice. Then there's Sweden. I was just there in Sweden. Remarkable what they've achieved. They have an air force and a navy. Also civil defense. Again, they weren't inside NATO and they had no choice. One could argue that the Poles have a substantial armed forces. Of course, Turkey does. Probably the most formidable armed force inside NATO. And then Ukraine, which is not in NATO, but also has one of the most impressive armed forces and now defense industrial complex. So you have some countries, most of which were not in NATO until recently or are still not in NATO, and they have a certain seriousness. And then you move on to those other countries that have done well with the peace dividend. Who can argue against the peace dividend? It's a winner in all societies, as it should be, because peace is better than war. The problem is you need the formidable military in order to maintain the peace, in order to deter potential adversaries. So that's one thing that could happen in theory, but is not happening in reality, and I don't see it on the horizon. So instead of that, we could get a Nordic alliance of countries, a kind of Northeastern Europe, that would not be a full NATO, but would be formidable enough to deter Russia and, if necessary, also fight against Russia. So that would be, as I said, Finland, Sweden, Poland, alongside Ukraine, potentially also Norway. I'm not sure Turkey would participate in that, unfortunately. The challenge for them, they have a certain degree of interoperability already. They have a certain complementarity. They could do this. In embryo already, they could do this. The challenge in the Nordic area, a kind of mini NATO, if you will, is one, the larger NATO still exists and it's sort of in their way. And they're not ready to surrender the existing NATO, of course. Some of them just joined. The other challenge is they don't know who's in command. What NATO does for you is it puts the command question off the table because the Americans are in command. That's it. And so you can't fight over who's going to be the supreme commander. The French always want to be the supreme commander. The UK has a certain claim to supreme command. In the North, who's it going to be? A Swedish officer as supreme commander? Well, would the Poles accede to that? Would they fight under a Swedish commander? How about the Finns? They like to talk about how they gave Sweden their freedom in the 19th century, the Finns, as we know, having been part of Sweden. And so solving this command problem where there's an unambiguous commander and that other troops from other countries fight under that commander's command, that's the hardest problem to solve, and they're nowhere near solving that. So even if they could overcome the inheritance, the legacy of reliance on NATO, when you might have to move more quickly and the rest of NATO is not equipped to move more quickly because of the slacker soldier problem. Even if they could solve that, they still have to solve this collective action problem of supreme command. But this is where the trend is moving. The trend is moving to the Northeast will defend itself no matter what the rest of NATO does. If there is a failure to rise to the occasion, either because of something happening in Berlin or in Washington or you pick whatever, or in multiple places simultaneously, the Northeast won't just stand aside and let things happen. So the Baltic states, the Nordic states, Poland, and anybody else who wants to join this coalition, as it were, to prevent Russian gains, territorial or otherwise, I think that will happen out of necessity. I think, again, that's the trend line. There are these obstacles to get to that trend line. So I would invest very heavily in command structures for a Northeastern mini version of NATO. Again, not to undermine NATO. I would prefer NATO function as a whole. But if I'm realistic about who could do this in the short term.
And who wants to do it.
I see that option. The other thing I see is destruction of the unanimity, the false unanimity in Putin's Russia by peeling off the dissatisfied elites from the regime. We did the stupidest thing imaginable, and I will take some credit here of having been opposed to this when it happened and not being a significant figure, and I don't have a government position, but having argued with officials about this. I said, what you're doing with the economic sanctions is you are pushing members of the Russian elite closer to Putin while blaming them for their proximity to Putin, the reason you're laying the sanctions. And I said, your policy goal should be to separate them from the Putin regime and draw them away from Putin, if not all the way to your side, at least to neutrality, to exile, to refusing to bankroll the Putin regime or run those factories. And yes, it wouldn't have been easy, and it's still not easy today. But our goal must be to have some type of attractive offer to the elites who know that this war is sacrificing Russia's future for goals being pursued personally by Putin and the few cronies around him. They are Russian patriots. They feel for Russia's trajectory being self-defeating. They would maybe not be so sentimental towards Ukraine on its own terms, but they love Russia. And so for the sake of Russia, you could imagine retrenchment on the part of these elites. Stop the war against Ukraine. Again, not because they love Ukraine or have some soft spot for Ukraine, but because they feel it's mortgaging Russia's future and undermining Russia's present. And so there's quite a pervasive sentiment within Russian circles, second echelon, third echelon. That sentiment is very widespread. There are high risks, high costs to voicing that sentiment, people falling out of windows or worse than falling out of windows, their family members being imprisoned and tortured. And so this is not a simple proposition, but that's where Europe needs to get active. So you have a sanctions relief package, a sell your oil to Europe package. You have a bunch of things that you put on the table to draw these people, to incentivize them to potentially break with the regime. Maybe it doesn't happen. Maybe it doesn't happen publicly. Maybe it doesn't happen quickly. But put that on the table to destabilize Putin's regime. Get his attention. Get him thinking that his regime is not so secure. So maybe it's better for him to cut a deal with Ukraine that's not maximalist in his demands. For example, no limit on Ukraine's armed forces, no recognition of the annexations, even if Ukraine can't reverse the territorial occupation that currently Russia has over their territory. And of course, no limit on Ukraine's sovereignty in the sense of choosing what organizations or associations it wants to join. So a kind of armistice at the current line where the major fighting stops. And so Ukraine is no longer being wrecked and can rebuild itself, right? That's the only favorable outcome on the horizon for Ukraine. We can't get there unless there is this maximalist pressure in the political domain, not merely in the military and economic domains, but in the third, in the political domain against Putin's regime. And so one thing I've been strongly advocating for, again, I'm not in government. I don't have a security clearance. I'm not close to any of the policy making per se. I advocate this on the occasions when I'm invited to discuss policy in government circles or publicly like we're doing now over podcasts or other means. But I see this as an option for Europe to try to destabilize, undermine the Putin regime. So people say, well, that's escalatory. And so, in other words, Putin can try to undermine all the European political systems now while we're speaking on this podcast. But if the Europeans were to answer and to try to do the same thing back, that would be escalatory. They'd be So this is the trap that we've laid for ourselves. He is doing what it is that he accuses us of doing, and we're not doing what he's accusing us of doing while being charged and convicted publicly for regime change activities. Let me clarify, we don't actually have to take his regime down. We don't have to change the regime in Russia. We just have to change his calculus about the stability or instability of his regime as a result of these pressures. And so he could be the one who initiates the retrenchment, which would be certainly denounced on the Russian Telegram channels, the hardline voices. They're not that many. They're quite loud, but would be welcomed in open arms, if quietly, by the whole society and certainly by huge numbers of elites. And so could we get there? Could Europe step up and do some of the intervention in Russian politics that Putin is doing to Europe, at the same time as it prepares more significantly and conspicuously militarily with societal mobilization. So I don't think those things can happen in reality. I think they can happen in theory. Maybe I'm wrong about some of the details. Maybe someone can refute me about some of the points. I'd be happy to learn about areas in which I need more education on this question. But my sense is we're stuck bluffing, promising these non-existent soldiers for this non-existent peace that's not coming because of our lack of pressure. And so we certainly can send more anti-aircraft, and they're absolutely necessary, and we can put more anti-aircraft on NATO countries' eastern flank. I'd be very happy to see that, and we see some movement in that direction. And certainly Mark Rutte is a fantastic General Secretary of NATO, and certainly the European officials understand everything that I'm saying quite well. But I see a kind of societal constraint, a political constraint on Europe. It's just not ready for the epoch in which it's now living.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And one of the things you've highlighted there very eloquently is are those divisions within Europe itself, that Europe has needed, to some extent, the United States to unify it in terms of its military, its membership of NATO. It's Washington that unifies in a way, because when you're talking about, there's a very different attitude towards Russia in Eastern Europe, in the Nordic countries, because of proximity, because of geography, because of history, certainly with Poland. It's a very different issue when you're in Germany or France, and I think very explicitly in the way that Spanish politicians have reacted to the idea of being in NATO in Spain and Italy. So it looks to me like a fairly hopeless position in terms of that unifying factor in Europe as a whole. Though I agree with you very much about that Northern Arc, a potential there, again, because of the historical knowledge and the geographic proximity of those countries to Russia, who understand the bear all too well.
And they have a higher level of readiness already. It's not something that's being discussed. They want to raise that level of readiness even higher. But they do have a higher level of readiness already now, as we're speaking. And so that's a major asset for us, because if I'm right, that's the problem for Europe as a whole. Now, of course, Putin has this knowledge of where the vulnerabilities are, where the divisions are in Europe, what's happening in Spain versus what's happening in Estonia. Of course, that's all true. However, sometimes when someone steps forward, others can follow even if they're not the leaders. You know, I remember the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, and people celebrate the Velvet Revolution now. And it was actually not such something to celebrate, in my view, because it happened really, really late in the game. They didn't have a lot of first movers there. And it was only when it was clearer that the consequences were minimal to non-existent that you saw some, let's call it, political mobilization in Czechoslovakia. This is not to put them down. I don't have the kind of courage to go out there and risk my life for my political beliefs. And if push comes to shove and I live in a situation where it's required, I don't know how I would act either. So, but as an observer, not someone who's being critical because I'm Andrei Sakharov or I'm Václav Havel or I'm someone like Mandela who spent 27 years in prison, right? I'm not those kind of people, and so I don't argue from that point of view. But just looking at how late to the game they came, but it was triggered by those who finally stood up. Some had stood up earlier and didn't trigger anything, but those people who moved and showed that it was possible galvanized a whole society very quickly.
I think that's a very interesting point, Stephen, because I was there at that point in 88, 89, in Czechoslovakia as it was, and also in Poland and Hungary. And if there was one country where I thought there was going to be a very strong resistance to a kind of counter-revolution, then it would have been Czechoslovakia, because it was a very authoritarian regime, and it was one that seemed pretty willing to use violence to me. But as you say, these are those contingent moments in history where sometimes someone does stand up, a person like Havel and those around him, and the other side backs down. That was the other thing, and that is the impossible thing to judge. It worked with the Velvet Revolution, but those are the kind of questions and the kind of courageous principles and moves that we might find out about Putin and we might find out about ourselves.
Yes, so the divisions in Europe are real, as you've outlined. But should parts of Europe stand up, other parts of Europe might follow. Everyone's afraid of this escalation problem. Wouldn't that be escalatory? Having just been in Sweden, people were asking me the question, was it really such a good idea to join NATO? Because now Putin might escalate against Sweden. And so I said to them, he's been escalating the whole time against Sweden. But at least now you have the protection of the alliance. It wasn't you're joining the alliance that's provoking him into taking these actions against you. He's been taking these actions and you're not standing up to it. Now at least you have much more support. Sweden certainly had a degree of interoperability with NATO before they joined. That's why the accession process has been so smooth, more or less. What Sweden didn't have was a voice at the table in the planning and design and planning phases. They had to accept as fait accompli NATO policies. Now they're at the table to discuss. And so that's a great advantage to be there for the input, not just on the receiving end, but the mentality, which is completely understandable. And again, I'm not a person of such courage that has spent time in prison for my political beliefs that I have this track record that I can criticize others. But what's interesting is the mentality of fear of escalation, fear of war. Oh my God, what if he attacks us now because we're a member of NATO? And so this leads me to the point which I think is not widely enough discussed or accepted at a deep psychological level, is that there is no peace anymore. Mm-hmm. There used to be peace and war, and you knew the difference, especially if you had fought any front line in a war. Now, there's no peace in the sense that everything is interconnected. So your water supply, or your electricity grid, or your public sphere, and your media, or your political system, or the refrigerator in your home, are all now points of vulnerability that are under attack 24/7. Sometimes by just a teenager in the basement somewhere, but often by your adversaries, state actors, and they do this not with complete impunity, but close to complete impunity. Attribution problems, not knowing what level of response is appropriate for a cyber attack as opposed to being bombed with missiles, right? Bombed with missiles, you think, oh, that's an act of war. Destabilizing your political system, oh, gee, that's just intervention in your political system. But of course, that's an act of war, and it requires a more serious response than we're seeing. And so there, peace is gone now. Even if Russia doesn't invade Estonia, Estonia has been under attack for almost since independence. Certainly since the 2000s when Russia regained its footing. And so they're under attack. There is no peace. And you can't have peace because of the interconnectivity. Now, you're still a young man, Paul, but I remember the 1960s and 70s. And nothing was interconnected then. And so the idea of invading someone's electricity grid and being ready to turn it off in wartime, back then it would have been blowing it up in wartime, not turning it off. That was a significant proposition because you had to get onto that person's territory. You had to plant the devices. Those devices had to go undetected. They had to be ready to go even if you weren't servicing them over time as time was passing. Now it's about flipping a switch here and flipping a switch there. It's about breaking the cryptography or finding someone's password through a phishing. You don't even need cryptography breaking. You just, the phishing example, you send them an attachment, they open the attachment, and the next thing you know, you're inside their energy grid or their financial system, their personnel files, whatever it might be. So that's the end of peace as we used to understand peace. And so Europe is at war. Not just Ukraine is at war, and not just drone incursions. There is a 24/7 incursion into European societies, politics, economies for some time now.
Do you think Europe's waking up to that? Because it strikes me that if we look at the Baltic states, if we look at Poland, if we look at Finland and Sweden, the countries that we've talked about already, and certainly Ukraine, they've been quite innovative in terms of the resistance to this new form of warfare or this lack of peace, however you might label that. But it strikes me that the rest of Europe has been quite slow to wake up to this. And even in the way it talks about defeating Russia or taking on Russia, it seems to think in militaristic terms, which are rather old-fashioned in a way, that simply weight of numbers or whatever, you know, they're still fighting the Cold War, rather than this new form of warfare.
To take or hold territory, or retake territory that's been conquered, you need soldiers. You need human beings. That's why you need those 500,000 18 to 24-year-olds in Ukraine. That problem has not been solved. But when you're under attack the way we're describing it in what's sometimes called hybrid warfare, and there are many different names to this now, none of which are adequate, there's no doubt that at a level of consciousness, at a level of recognition, everybody recognizes this. It's banal. Everything I'm saying is completely banal. The problem is, what's escalatory? What could provoke, quote, hot war? And so if Russia implants malware in your electricity system, why is Russia's electricity system continuing to function? I don't understand that. I would show them that I can shut it off, and I would shut it off for a week or a day, whatever I could pull off. Why does their financial system still work at home? Why don't I shut that off? Why don't I cause significant havoc in some infrastructure, government function, or societal function in Russia?
And why don't we?
Yeah, because it would be, quote, escalatory. It could, quote, lead to war. So at the level of rhetoric, recognition, consciousness, 100%. But at the level of action, what do you do now that you recognize this? Now that you see the intrusions in your cyber architecture, in your domestic infrastructure, what response is appropriate and how can you contain that response so that the counter response and the escalation ladder doesn't lead to invasion, missile strikes? Because you fear the missile strikes. You look at what's happening in Ukraine and you think that's horrible and we should help their self-defense, but I don't want that to happen in my country. Again, there are variations here. Some European countries are risking more than others, and they have, as you called it, proximity to Russia that fixes the mind. And so I'm not advocating all-out war with Russia. I'm not advocating that we get as aggressive as Russia. I'm not advocating that we take that regime down tomorrow in special ops, covert operations. I'm advocating that we do some things that we have the capabilities of doing in order to show that we can do them and we're going to do them if you do what you're doing, and that we are not afraid of escalation. We can have diplomacy at the same time, and we can discuss the parameters of our activities, and we can say, we're doing this because of you. This is a response to your actions. We don't intend to bomb with missiles your blah, blah, blah factories. This is, however, a necessary response because what you're doing, and we know what you're doing, and we're watching it, and we're feeling it, experiencing it, and we want it to stop, and this is how So this topic comes up most vividly with the air incursions, the invasion of your airspace. Should you shoot the plane down or not? Because, of course, that looks like an act of war, shooting the plane down. Never mind that crossing into your airspace deliberately with fuel tanks that have been added to the drones to allow them to go farther than they normally would go Never mind that that already is the act of war that you're afraid not to commit yourself. But can you shoot down drones that invade your airspace? Is that escalatory? Does that bring you to hot war or not? And you can see with the level of difficulty we have with that debate, the difficulty in this proposition. If we don't figure out, however, how to shoot down those drones in real time as a legitimate response, then, of course, those drone incursions will not only continue, but other versions of them will follow. Turkey shot down quite a number of years ago, 10 years ago now, maybe. I'm not as good with time as I used to be since my hair turned white. Let's just call it that. But about 10 years ago, Turkey shot down some significant Russian fighter aircraft. And it was a message. Turkey has a military. They have a formidable air force. And they're going to use it if you try to push them around. And the message got across. And Russia didn't all of a sudden start saying, we're going to war with Turkey. We're going to take on Turkey's army, let alone the NATO army. They said, oh, you know, maybe it was a mistake and we apologize and we'll be careful not to do it again. Okay. So we have instances where it was possible. The U.S. killed the Wagner fighters. Again, there were Wagner fighters in areas that the Russians denied that their military was located in a Middle Eastern country. And the U.S. didn't like what they were doing and felt that it was dangerous, a threat, and took them out, killed them. And the Russians didn't do anything in response. So what do you know? So you can film the incursion. You can film it in real time with high tech. And you can issue a warning. And you can say, well, we don't think this was an accident. These are the reasons why. And give the evidence. We say this is an act of war. We, however, are a peace-loving country. And we're not looking to go to war. But should you do this again, we will shoot them down and see what other measures are necessary to make sure that these kinds of aggressive violations of our sovereign territory, our sovereign airspace, don't take place. And you use the filming of the episode as your front foot public relations campaign, and you discuss how you don't want war and that you are not an aggressive country, but you show that the other side committed an act of war and you lay down the law. And if they do it again, you then have to not be bluffing. You actually have to enact those measures that maybe you've threatened vague measures. You haven't specified exactly what the measures might be. But you act in a way, and you film that as well. And then you talk about how regrettable that was. That is just certainly regrettable. We're not looking for war. We would prefer diplomacy. We would prefer that our sovereign airspace remain inviolate, as it should be under international law. The other thing you have to do, Paul, is you have to find those areas of vulnerability on the Russian side. In other words, sometimes you don't respond exactly to the place or at the place or in the same way as the aggression. You find another way to respond where you're stronger and they're vulnerable. You choose the response point. So if your airspace is violated, you might want to shoot down their plane if it does it again, or you might want to respond somewhere else where you're confident of your strengths and you know that they have vulnerabilities. And so there are tankers, shadow tankers at sea. Maybe you want to board them. Maybe you want to board them and inventory what's on them. And if they're found to be in violation of law, maybe you want to confiscate them. Maybe you want to surround them and ask them to allow you to inspect their cargo because they're claiming that they're not in violation of international law, so they have nothing to hide. So there are a number of measures and places and interventions that are possible. Again, you're not doing this because you want World War III. But not doing anything like we're doing now is, of course, the pathway to the escalation on the adversary side, probing, finding the mush, and sticking the bayonet in farther and farther. And so this is hard for European societies. Again, not because they're bad people. They're tremendous people, and they enjoy a quality of life that's the envy of the world. And you want to preserve that quality of life. Who wants to spend money on weaponry when you can spend money on better schools or better care for your elderly who are a growing part of your population? I mean, we all understand that. And so the challenge is your mentality, your success, your post-1989 successes in the peace dividend is now an entrenched societal mentality, interest groups. And so turning that around, even with all that's happened, is something that politicians are doing at the rhetorical level, the factories are doing at the level of building munitions or other necessary weapons. Your defense industrial complex has certainly responded. Your budgets have changed a little bit, but you're still not there, and there's no peace anymore, and peace is not coming back.
And this also comes back to your point about chain of command as well, doesn't it? Because if the kind of strategies that you're outlining there were ever to come to fruition, this new form of war, it needs a chain of command just as much as traditional warfare needs it. And yet we still have the same problem in Europe of where that comes from. Now, this raises the question again that we haven't really talked about, and that's Washington. It's the US role in NATO and the US role in resisting not only Russia, but also in trying to wake up Europe to some kind of alarm for the future it faces if it doesn't change its mentality in some way. I mean, what's the American take on that?
The Trump administration, which I use the word as a metaphor because there is no administration, but the Trump administration has expressed the view on a number of occasions, whether from the president or from others, that Europe must do this, that America will support you, but Europe, you have to do this. There's a fundamental rebalancing of American power in the world underway that predates President Trump. So when the U.S. formed the what we call the U.S.-led international order, sometimes people call it the liberal world order or the rules-based order, and whatever you want to call it, however you want to describe it, it was formed when the U.S. dominated across every sphere, especially economically, right? U.S. GDP has been 25% of global GDP since 1880. Through tariffs, through lack of tariffs, through income taxes, through lack of income taxes, we tend to over-index on policy. The U.S. has this unbelievably dynamic economy. Again, since 1880, more or less 25%. Some years 22%, some years 28%. So 5% of the global population is 25% of global GDP. That's still the case today, and that's going to be the case in the foreseeable future. But there was this moment from 45 to 1960 when the U.S. share was much, much higher because Europe had committed this fratricide and was laid to waste, and Japan as well was ashes, literally. And so there's this anomalous moment when the U.S. is greater than 25% of global GDP, reached about 40% of global GDP at peak, 50% of global manufacturing. I mean, this is just a dominance that is, no one's ever going to see that dominance again. And so that was a remarkable time when the U.S. could make promises, when the U.S. could set up mutual obligations where the U.S. provided a very significant part of the obligation. Now, these are voluntary treaties. They're very important. They're critical to U.S. peace and prosperity, not just to the neighbors in Europe, the Transatlantic Alliance, or the island chain, the first island chain in East Asia. So it's highly beneficial to the U.S. beyond doubt. And that's an empirical fact with multiple indicators. But it's a period that couldn't last forever. Moreover, you know that because the plan was that it wouldn't last forever. The plan was that everybody would be rebuilt, that the U.S. would invest alongside its new treaty allies, its partners, and would grow them. And so the rest of the world was going to rise, which meant that U.S. power relative to everybody else, even if U.S. power didn't decline in absolute terms, and it hasn't declined in absolute terms, it's only grown, in relative terms, there would be a dilution. When George Shultz, my colleague until he passed at the Hoover Institution, formed the G5, which became the G7, this is in 1973 in response to the oil shock, and he brings the Treasury secretaries, the finance ministers together to discuss how to respond, and eventually this G5 becomes the G7, and it's a pillar of the global world order. The G7 was about 70% of global GDP, and now it's 40%, if that. But that was the plan, Paul. That was deliberate. That was what we were trying to do, and we succeeded. And so with that success comes a necessary rebalancing of U.S. power, meaning that the U.S. has too many commitments, and the demand for American power is unlimited. And so people say, well, let's bring Ukraine into NATO. That's another commitment of U.S. power. Let's have a security treaty with the Saudis, Saudi Arabia and the U.S., a security treaty. That's another extension, another commitment, U.S. power. So the demand for U.S. power is unlimited. It's the supply that's not unlimited. And so in that rebalancing, which is underway, it was promised for quite some time. Certainly Bush talked about this, Obama's pivot to Asia, Biden tried in his own way. And Trump is now doing it in the Trumpian fashion. Not the way necessarily that I would do it or you would do it, but this is the way the American system is finally making it happen, forcing it to happen. It's very unpleasant. It's very, let's say, destabilizing, the uncertainty around it. But it's absolutely necessary, and it must happen, and it was going to happen, and this is the way, for better or for worse, it's happening. So the place to start with the rebalancing, objectively speaking, was going to be Europe. So we have 5% of global population with 25% of global GDP and 50% of global military spending, more or less, especially in qualitative terms. This is the U.S. Then we have Europe, which is 7% of global population and 17% of global GDP and nearly 50% of global social spending. So that's where you were going to rebalance. Again, not because the Europeans are bad people or bad allies. They're fantastic people. They're amazing allies. And thank God for transatlanticism. But you got to understand that the U.S. has commitments here, there, and everywhere. The Middle East, South Asia, East Asia, Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia. I mean, Latin America. Never mind the homeland. So how is that going to work? It's going to work with Europe taking greater and greater responsibility for its own security. Now, you can say Americans are culprits here. We enjoyed Europe being dependent on us, and we encouraged that dependency. And so we're at fault for what we're now trying to rebalance. And I would say, yes, we are. All of that is true. But doesn't vitiate the point that the rebalancing is necessary. It's happening, and you have to now rebalance. It's painful. Of course it's painful. And the way it's happening leads people to question whether America really is going to use force and keep its commitments. That's the wrong way to look at it. Trump is not a person who is driven by national security concerns. National security rarely impinges on Trump's agenda when he can set the agenda. He's very interested in trade, by which he means tariffs. He's very interested in immigration, by which he means restrictions of immigration. And he's very, very interested, more than anything else, in retribution, in culture war, in fighting his enemies. And by the way, there's some cause to Trump's anger and grievances, even if anger and grievances is not a way to run an American administration. So foreign policy, national security, rarely intervenes from Trump's initiative. He's forced to face it sometimes because of world events, things happen, and it gets pushed onto his agenda. When that happens, he's generally quite hawkish, as you saw in the Iranian case. He wanted to deal with Iran. He was killing himself to get a deal with Iran. Mm. And he kept telling them, you guys, listen, I want to do a deal. And they kept spitting in his face. For whatever reason, they were unable to perceive the moment. And Trump still, even when they spat in the face and refused to negotiate, he still was hesitant. Then the Israelis did what they did. They took on Iranian power. They showed how empty it was, Iranian power. They were able to fly for hours and hours over Iranian airspace with complete impunity. They took down Iran's anti-aircraft, its air defenses, and much else, missile factories, and just remarkable, the Israeli operation. So Trump decided to seize that opportunity, and he destroyed Iran's nuclear program. People are arguing how much he wrecked that thing. They sent bombers for 36 hours from the center of America to the Middle East and back safely, dropping the biggest bombs in existence, a dozen plus of them, into these mountains, down these air shafts that they, of course, knew existed, even though they were hidden and covered. And they hit the target and the blast wave inside, deep underground, etc. And then there were other ways that they hit the other facilities. And there was an amazing act of hawkishness. You can argue it was a bad idea, it was a good idea. Let's leave that aside and let's just see that Trump has hawkish instincts that should not be gainsaid. Now, again, national security is not his first priority. He's got a lot of these other priorities, and national security is something he generally comes to it reluctantly, let's say. And so with the Europeans, there have been insults, J.D. Vance and the Munich speech and everything else. But the bottom line has been, you guys move forward and you guys do these things and we're with you. That's the message that Trump himself has delivered on a number of occasions. And he doesn't want to be humiliated. He doesn't want people to take advantage of him. He's got the biggest fish to fry, the China relationship. That's properly his number one priority. Again, we can argue whether he's handling it well, mishandling it, but you can't argue that it shouldn't be his number one priority, or that he should focus more on what's happening in Eastern Europe as opposed to what's happening across the rest of the globe, including in the Indo-Pacific. Again, he's doing a bad job, he's doing a good job. It's right that there is this rebalancing underway, and it's necessary in any case, whether you agree that it's right or not. And so that's an opportunity for Europe that they need to seize, and they have the wherewithal to seize this. Sure, some European air forces can't refuel in the air. They have these fantastic fighter jets, and they can fly a certain number of kilometers, and then they run out of fuel. Sure. And America's the one that can refuel in the air. We understand these things. There are certain capabilities that the Europeans are not going to develop overnight, and there are no substitutes for, including on the intelligence side. Okay, so you have to keep that in the game. You say, well, we don't need you for this, and we don't need you for that, but these are the pieces that we really need. You negotiate that. All the American kit that's in Europe right now is no longer NATO kit. It's all Indo-Pacific kit. There is not enough kit in the Indo-Pacific or in American storehouses on U.S. territory for the Indo-Pacific. And so everything everywhere, wherever it's warehoused, including in European warehouses, right? U.S. is about 40% or so of NATO kit overall, depending how you count. That's all Indo-Pacific kit at this point. God forbid there's a war in East Asia. We're on the pathway towards that. God forbid that happens. All that stuff's getting evacuated to the Pacific theater immediately. Those transport planes are going to be zooming out of our bases, Ramstein Air Base in Germany, with all of that kit. So you can write it off now if you're Europe. Again, not because America's abandoning Europe, but there's just not enough kit for the Indo-Pacific. So you have to say, okay, how can we get to where we get, where we need to get? How can we get, what's the pathway to where we need to get, assuming that we don't have this and we don't have that and we don't have this, but these few things we absolutely must have, they're indispensable. And so that's a conversation you can have with the defense establishment in Europe. I've been having those conversations. Again, I have no security clearance. I don't know any secrets. nor should I know any secrets. But there's a great awareness of all of this. But the ability of the society, let alone the political systems, to accept these realities, and again, for good reasons, that's where the rubber is not hitting the road, and that's where we're on a bad trajectory, and that's where Putin's probing has now frightened people to the point where he's emboldened, despite all his vulnerabilities and weaknesses and failures, and the guy has ruined Russia's long-term trajectory with this short-term pummeling of Ukraine, sacrificing at least 1 million casualties, at least 300,000 dead, and all the kit he had before the 2022, which is lost, he's lost a significant portion of his strategic bombers from the Ukrainian ingenuity of using drones deep in Siberia. He's losing his oil refineries. He doesn't have a civilian economy anymore. He's only got a military economy, and all this financial system, the Russian banks, are extending loans to military plants that are never going to pay them back. So he's got a Ponzi scheme financial system. His whole 21st century economy lives in Tel Aviv and Yerevan and Istanbul. And he doesn't have a 21st century economy. Sure, he's got those drones that Iran transferred the technology and the Russians improved it slightly and they're being used to great effect, unfortunately, in Ukraine. But they have the lowest level of robotization of any middle or high-income country. I mean, they have no future economy, and they don't even have a civilian economy. All the automobile industry that they had domestically, they lost that. And so he's made these enormous miscalculations that the Russian elites understand, even if they can't say publicly all the time, they can't criticize him. And so let's feed that critique of Russia that the Russians themselves would like to make. Let's extend, entice, attract those people out of the Putin regime on behalf of a better future for Russia. Let's offer them something, but let's at the same time show that we're serious people.
Well, you've mentioned, Stephen, when talking about Trump, that Trump sees the big challenges as China. Rightly so. What do you think Trump's aims are there? And what do you think actually are America's aims when Trump is gone, when Trump is long gone? What is the relationship likely to be like between the U.S. and China?
Nobody knows. And that's why we're living through the uncertainty and the worries that we have. So China and America have never both been superpowers at the same time until now. Qing China overextended itself and went into this tunnel around 1800 or so. And we have the opium wars, and now we have the reverse opium wars with the fentanyl, but we have this going into the tunnel that China did from around 1800 or so. For the vast period before 1800, China was a superpower. And of course, that's no longer the case. As the Qing decline, they come out of this tunnel beginning in the late 70s, 80s. So America becomes a country right when China goes into the tunnel. And America rises to be a global superpower as China's undergoing what they call the century of humiliation. They rarely mention the half century of self-humiliation, where the Chinese regime has killed many more Chinese than any foreigner has ever killed. The foreigners, sadly, did intervene in China and uninvited, and there's a big nasty history there that we all need to know. But the Chinese communists have outdone all of that, and then some. But that whole period of century of humiliation and half century plus of self-humiliation corresponds to America becoming this superpower in all these domains: energy superpower, military superpower, economic, tech and science superpower, cultural superpower, soft power superpower. I mean, in ways that just no other power has ever been, including a Pacific power, right? The U.S., California is the fourth largest economy in the world today, larger than Japan. It's a Pacific Rim economy. And so all that happened with China in the tank. Now China's on the other side of that, partly because the U.S. and China partnered economically, by the way, so that China followed the same model of Japan, just on bigger scale, which was access to the American domestic market and manufacturing and moving up the value chain. Deng stole this from the Japanese because the Japanese had been reduced to ashes, literally, in World War II. And in 1969, Japan was the second largest economy in the world. So how'd they do that? And Deng visits Japan in 1979 before he actually goes to the U.S. and visits Carter and gets the most favored nation status exception for a communist regime in early 1980, and then they're off to the races in this partnership. But neither side knows how to deal with each other. Neither side knows what to do. How do the Chinese manage American power, and how do the Americans manage Chinese power? And so we can certainly level criticisms at President Trump, and what is he up to, and does he really have a strategy, and is this really going in the right direction, and shouldn't there be this policy or that policy instead? And we can certainly go through Xi Jinping and say, does he really know what he's doing? And is this really in China's interests, and et cetera? So those critiques are made on all sides by each side. What's the right way to do this? Well, that is still an open question, and both sides are fumbling their way to this. We think of the 1940s U.S.-led order as something that sort of was born. You know, George Kennan wrote a telegram, and a bunch of wise men in Washington decided to do X, Y, and Z, and then wrote Present at the Creation. And it was a very bumpy road to discover what the institution should look like, what the behavior should look like, what escalation should be or not be, how we were going to live with each other in these systems that were faced off against each other. So we're not in the same situation now, of course. Not history never repeats itself. That's silly. But certainly we are in a situation where we have these two superpowers of different kinds and of different weights and different domains that don't know how to be with each other. So I would just say this. We have to share the planet with China. There's no going around that. However long the tunnel they were in, that 180-year tunnel, it is a blip in Chinese history. They're going to be there tomorrow. Even if there's convulsions, they'll come out the other side again at some point. And so we need to find a way to live with them. America's not disappearing. China's not disappearing. The entire issue is, what are the terms of sharing the planet? Because if the terms are Xinjiang, I don't like those terms. If the terms are what happened to formerly British Hong Kong, I don't like those terms. If the terms are the repression that the Chinese have at home that they try to apply abroad while talking about win-win, I don't like those terms. So I need somehow to figure out more favorable terms, more favorable for freedom, those favorable terms, while acknowledging that the Chinese are going to exist and we have to share the planet. And the Trump administration doesn't know the answer to that. And the critics of the Trump administration think they know the answer to that, and I'm not sure that they do. Again, not because they're bad people, they're really smart people. But this is a really big proposition that's multi-generational, especially now that there's no peace anymore, that between peace and war, there's this huge space. And so I'm concerned about all of this. It's where we have to get this right. The Second World War was 55 million dead at the lowest estimate, which, of course, is a multiple of the First World War. So if this happens again, we're going to get a multiple of the 55 million. Not only that, the planet is going to be wrecked. You've got oil tankers in choke points. They're going to be destroyed. You're going to get an oil spill the size of the ocean. You have gas pipelines, they're either going to be shut down by cyber or they're going to blow and they're going to burn. There's going to be such destruction, death, and ruin on this planet if, God forbid, we end up in the Third World War. And so everything is about that. Absolutely everything. And that's a process, a learning process where each side learns what the other side's limits might be. We're nowhere near where we need to be in that process.
Where do we need to be?
We need to be where each side understands that the possibility of the Third World War is not abstract but real and needs to be avoided. We got that way with the Soviets. they could have destroyed this planet multiple times over. You know, each side had 40,000 nuclear weapons, let alone the chemical weapons and the secret biological weapons. I mean, 40,000 nuclear weapons per side, and yet it never came to that. There were moments, and we know those moments well, the documents and the oral histories. That was a learning process. Here's, I think, where we'll close. The Soviet Union had borders of victory. We remember the Helsinki Final Act, 1975, which for us was a human rights agreement, where we wanted them to recognize the universality of human rights. What did they care? That was a throwaway for them. They had this huge repressive apparatus. For them, Helsinki 1975 was about post-World War II Soviet borders. We recognized their borders. And those were borders of victory. They won the war. They had the military occupation right through to Berlin, and they converted that into the satellites. They had a strong position in Northeast Asia, so they won, and they wanted to consolidate those gains. You can have detente with borders of victory. The Soviet Union became a status quo power. It was invested in some version of the status quo. That doesn't mean it was happy about everything in the status quo, and neither were we, but there was a way in which there were two status quo powers, which happened as a result of the learning process in the Cold War, figuring that out, but also because there were borders of victory. Now you have borders of defeat. Ukraine, that's a border of defeat for Russia. Israel, that existence of Israel is a border of defeat for many Arabs and certainly for Iran. Taiwan, border of defeat. After all, the Chinese Civil War is not over yet. They're still on Taiwan, where they retreated in 1949. And so borders of defeat is a much more difficult proposition for detente than borders of victory, status quo powers. And so that is why this is not like the first version of the Cold War. That's the main reason. Sure, there's economic integration on a scale that we didn't have before, and there are many other differences. But this borders of defeat problem. And then if you overturn the borders of defeat, the appetite grows in the eating. So you think, Taiwan will be enough. And once I get that, and we're satisfied. But the appetite always grows in the eating. And so you think there's a limit, a self-imposed limit on the other side looking to revise the borders. And that limit disappears if there's success. There is no self-restraint once there's success. So you're trying to deny revision of the borders of defeat and figure out how to share the planet. Paul, good luck, and I hope you can figure this out in the Engelsberg ideas.
Well, I can't say that I feel more optimistic than when we began this conversation, but I can say I think considerably better informed. So, Stephen Cockin, thank you very much indeed. That was fascinating.
Oh, thank you for the honor of the invitation once more.